Hey everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Jump Ball Podcast. I'm your host, Modoc Eel, and today my guest is Ben Golliver, senior writer for Sports Illustrated and co-host of the Open Floor Podcast. We're going to get into some of the Christmas games and just talk hoops, so you ready to tip it off?
I am so ready, Mo, my favorite Twitter video expert breaking down plays left and right. It's great to see your Twitter account having so much success. People are catching on. I love it. Yesterday, you know, Monday, Christmas, was a pretty good day of basketball. You know, everyone loves to hop on the, like, oh, Christmas, you know, it failed to deliver. Like, that seems like an annual tradition that people love to kind of hop on that train. I didn't think so yesterday. I thought yesterday was pretty good, despite, obviously, no Steph, no Chris Paul, a few other guys. But I thought it was a pretty good day of basketball front to back.
I thought the games were great. I think you're right on. Like, the first four games were, all of them were within 5 or 7 points by the end of the game. Like, these were close games pretty much all the way through. And then, you know, of course, the Lakers missing their main guys in Lonzo and Ingram. It was just an opportunity for Kuzma to go off. But, you know, four out of five games, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah, and we kind of knew which game was going to be the worst going in. I mean, even before Lonzo and Ingram were out for the Lakers, you kind of knew that nightcap game was going to be a rough watch, just the way the Timberwolves play and the fact that the Lakers are so far below 500. Hey, here's one question for you. I saw the Raptors chirping a little bit, like, you know, Lowry and DeRozan kind of saying, hey, we want to be on Christmas. And they've been snubbed really consistently here the last 3 years or so. You know, clearly San Antonio probably should have been on Christmas, you know, going by merit this year as well. But I think Toronto's got an even better grievance because, like, the Spurs were on in previous years and Toronto basically has not been on with this current era. Do you think the NBA should hold a spot for them next year and just say, look, if you keep winning 50 games, your guys, you know, your star guys are in their prime. Let's go ahead and slot them in, you know, regardless of the television demographics or whatever else it might be, because I think they've earned it. I think they have a point.
No, I mean, they have a point, but they're also not, like, the most exciting team to watch also. I know Minnesota isn't either, but they have a point. They should be on Christmas, but I don't feel like I was deprived because I didn't see the Toronto Raptors yesterday. You know, when I look at the lineup, I mean, Philly, New York, like, that's two up-and-coming teams with two amazing big men. Like, that's a fun matchup. Obviously, Golden State, Cleveland, finals rematch for, like, the umpteenth time. Like, that's a fun matchup. Washington and Boston going to game 7 last year, and I know a lot of pieces have changed in Boston, but, you know, you kind of want to relive that, and you hope that becomes a bit of a rivalry. Houston and OKC, kind of same thing, interdivision. I think they're in the right. No, they're in different divisions. Right? Who cares?
Divisions. Well, they're kind of like a regional rivalry because it's right up and down the freeway from each other. And there's definitely a lot of, like, bitterness, you know, between those two fan bases over the whole MVP thing and everything. So that was a nice rivalry pick, I thought, by the league.
Yeah. And then, you know, listen, Minnesota Lakers, like, it didn't quite mesh, but I don't know where you put Toronto in that. Like, you know, do you kick Minnesota out and have Toronto play the Lakers on Christmas Day? Okay. I mean, like, it's not that much of a, it's not a more exciting game. You know, I don't know where maybe you kick the Lakers out as well and do San Antonio, Toronto.
Well, here's my thought. I liked the Minnesota Lakers idea on paper just because you had so many young picks, you know, Towns, Wiggins, Ingram, Ball. I mean, that's a lot of young talent, so you could see why the NBA would want to do that. I also mentioned the Raptors first because I needed to get that out of the way, because what I really want is Christmas Giannis. How do we not have Giannis on Christmas? I mean, give me a break. This guy is going to be most likely in, like, 3 or 4 years, the best player in the league. Let's start this, you know, global branding initiative now on the NBA's biggest platform. Here's my idea, Mo. Tell me what you think. I think, and this is going to be a tough sell because a lot of teams don't want to be on Christmas, but some teams do, like the Raptors. What if instead of just having 5 games on Christmas, the NBA scheduled 6, but there was, like, a flex game? So a week before, you know, once we know the health status of most of the guys or whatever, one of those games gets flexed away from, say, ESPN or TNT and ABC, and maybe that game goes to NBA TV. So you still have that main quintuple header that's, like, on the national networks, but then you also have that one extra game for you know, kind of like a mini showcase, sort of like what they do early in the season. Sometimes, you know, they'll put like Orlando, Indiana on NBA TV on like the first or second game of the season. I just think that there's too many deserving teams here, and the NBA, it's a good problem to have. You want all of your young guys to be showcased, but to me, Giannis was missing, San Antonio was missing, Toronto was missing, and all the teams pretty much besides the Lakers deserve to be on that slate. So I think it's time to expand. Let's make Christmas even better.
See, that's funny, because I'm actually the opposite. I actually would like them to go to four games, because I personally can't handle the fifth game anymore.
I mean, it's tough. Like, if we could get a good last game, but when it's always the Lakers or the Clippers here in recent years, or sometimes they play each other, you just kind of knew what you were going to get. And I think if you rejiggered this thing, you could probably find a way to make it work. And let me ask you this: if it was Bucks Lakers last night at 7:30 p.m. Pacific, would you have watched that game? I think I would have watched it for sure, and I would have enjoyed it more than I did that Timberwolves game.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think Giannis does deserve that spotlight. And I think that would have been a really fun matchup, you know, Lakers-Milwaukee. That would have been a really good Christmas Day matchup, because then, assuming Lonzo doesn't get hurt and Ingram, that's the young matchups that you kind of want to see. Those another young, talented group of guys. Would that game end up having gotten flexed to NBA TV, though?
Good question. You know, I think it would get some real scheduling issues, right? Because, you know, it most likely would have, but at least, you know, that's better than nothing, I guess, is the way that I look at it, right? And I'm not saying that that needs to be like a punishment for these teams, like, oh, your guys are injured, therefore we take you off. But it would be a nice level of flexibility. Like, imagine that first game, Knicks Sixers, if Embiid was a late scratch because of his back. Like, that game was awesome. Like, it was really fun. Everyone wanted the unicorn showdown. It was great. But if Embiid's not playing, like, just sleep in, you know, have a second round of presents. Like, you know, go ahead and get brunch. Like, you don't necessarily need to watch that game. So the NBA is kind of stuck from that standpoint. I do think they could benefit from a little flexibility, because let's say Embiid sits, you flex that game off, you make sure Giannis is on, you know, ESPN, and you know, everybody's talking about the future of Milwaukee. You know, I just think it could probably be in the league's best interest to do that.
I'm with you, though. I think they should be able to flex more games throughout the year. You know, ESPN should be able to flex, you know, a couple games a year. Same for TNT. Just because sometimes you look at the lineup and you're just like, this game's on national TV, but these guys suck or whatever. Like you said, Embiid's not playing. The Sixers aren't that fun to watch when Embiid isn't playing. They're not fun to watch when he's off the court. So, I mean, it's a challenge. So I think you're right. I think the NBA would benefit altogether with just the ability to flex more of their national TV games.
Yeah, I felt bad earlier this week when it was like Spurs Jazz on TNT, I think. And, you know, Spurs are getting Kawhi back and the Jazz are kind of like walking wounded squad. It's like, what do you think the ratings are for that game? Like 14 people, you know, and that doesn't really serve the teams. It doesn't serve the networks. It doesn't serve the league. I do worry if they had like unlimited flexing ability, we would just get Lakers, 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 like literally every single game, regardless of whether, you know, they were actually a good team or not, just because of the market stuff. But, you know, I think the NBA's made some progress. I mean, I think that they diversified their Saturday night lineup a little bit this year, so it wasn't quite as predictable. That was nice. But they're also balancing a lot of things that we probably don't even know about as outsiders in terms of putting that schedule together. But I thought overall, we're sitting here nitpicking the Christmas schedule. Like I said earlier, it was a good day of games.
It was a good set of games. And let's talk about the first game, Philly Knicks. We kind of talked about it a little bit. That was a hell of a matchup with Porzingis and Embiid going at each other. Enes Kanter having a huge night or morning, I guess, was quite amazing. What were some of your takeaways from that game that you watched?
This is related to that game, but also related to how Philly's been playing in the last week or two without Embiid. Man, that guy is like the tide that raises all ships. Even for a player like Ben Simmons, who is awesome, and I'm like all in on Ben Simmons, he looks like a different guy when Embiid's on the court versus when Embiid's off the court. So when you're looking at like who impacts the game play to play on a superstar level, to me, Embiid is like up there, top five in the league in terms of if you take him off the court, his team just looks totally different right down the line, whether it's promising young rookie of the year prospects or role players. I also think they got to get these turnovers in order, don't they, Philadelphia? I mean, there's been a lot of discussion. Well, everyone should expect turnovers. I mean, look what they're trying to do. All these unconventional players, and they're young and they're new. They haven't played together. I get it. And Embiid's got to chill a little bit. The stuff in transition where he gets the defensive rebound, tries to push, or just throws the ball to absolutely no one, he's got to just ramp that down. Like, you can't have that and be a team that has real serious postseason aspirations. And I still think they should, by the way. To me, that's a team that should make the playoffs in the Eastern Conference. I don't know if they're going to win a series, but they should be there. Now's the time to do it. But they got to clean that stuff up. From the Knicks side, I think the main storyline is obvious, just the cloud of Melo being lifted. They are getting overachieving performances from so many different guys. You know, I definitely hear the people who are a little bit skeptical just because their schedule is going to get so difficult here, and they could see that pretty pristine record kind of falling apart on them. You know, I totally believe that. But the type of contributions they're getting from Kanter, who you mentioned, Michael Beasley, you know, right down the line, Hardaway, just guys who I never really thought were going to play as well as they have this season. You know, I do think the scary thing with that, though, is we've seen this with teams in the past. There was that Suns team that way overachieved and nearly made the playoffs. There was a Blazers team that was like full of like super anonymous guys, and they overachieved. The honeymoon period for young teams that kind of get thrown together and surprise people usually lasts one season at the most. And so I guess my bigger picture concern for the Knicks is, like, I wouldn't necessarily buy into all these guys who are playing well this year. Like, if it comes time to pay them in the near future, I mean, just kind of, you know, be careful or skeptical or critical in terms of, you know, how you're spending that money, because I don't think there's a lot of raw, pure talent on that roster outside of Porzingis and a couple other guys. I do like Ntilikina, but, you know, I wouldn't go head over heels over this group, even though they're very fun and probably one of the league's biggest pleasant surprises so far through Christmas.
Yeah, I think for starters, like going back to Philly and the turnovers, they lead the league in turnovers per game. Their advanced stats were 19% of their possessions end up in turnovers. And I'm working on something where it's literally some of these passes are just, what are you thinking? Like, these are just dumb, stupid passes. And sloppiness and the whole thing. So they do got to clean it up. And I'm tired of the young excuse. Like, yeah,
it starts with Embiid, don't you think? I mean,
oh, absolutely.
He
had six last night, or yeah, yesterday. I'm gonna say last night constantly for all these games because I'm used to them being at night. So, but he had six last night. That's a ton for your big guy. And I know how much he's usage and all of that and things like that. But if he can cut it down to just three, these games are massively different. You know, they lead the league in how many points off turnovers their opponents get. You know, it's like somewhere around like 18 or 19 points a night. Like, if you can cut that down to like 13 or 14, it makes a huge difference for you. And they're live ball turnovers. They're not even dead ball turnovers where you can go set your defense. So that's a big problem for Phil.
No. I totally agree. And with Embiid, there's going to be turnovers. Like, when you're in the post working regularly, you're big and physical, you're going to get those offensive foul calls. You're going to have guys swipe down, deflect your passes in the paint. Like, that just happens. Not that many people are played through a post player anymore in the NBA, but when you have a guy who's got the ball a lot and you really feed him, there's going to be mistakes. What you're hitting is dead on. It's the live ball stuff. It's the, hey, we're in the backcourt and we're trying to push the ball up the fast break. I'm taking dribbles that I shouldn't be taking. I'm making crazy cross-court passes without really looking to see if the guy I'm passing to is paying attention. Those are the ones that just have to go. I mean, there's no room in terms of margin of error for those kinds of mistakes where you're just giving, you know, your opponents extra bullets every single night. You can't do that.
Yeah, and live ball turnovers to me are worth two versus dead ball turnovers. You know, because it's just exactly that. It just kills you. It's a transition bucket, usually the other way. And now it's usually a transition three, so it's even worse. So the live ball turnovers are murderous. The other thing, too, and you hit it on, too, when Embiid's not on the court, this team really struggles. You know, yesterday he was a plus 25 or 24, you know, and it's just like, wow, that's insane, you know, and it makes a huge difference. The and the metrics and everything and the on-off numbers, which I don't have in front of me because I'm not good at preparing in advance, are pretty astronomical.
Well, let me ask you a question, Mo. So when we're talking about guys who have the biggest impact on their team aesthetically or just, you know, overall efficiency wise, I think we start with LeBron. You know, I would start to think about, you know, guys like Harden and Steph in this conversation. You know, Westbrook certainly last year especially was in this conversation. Like, who else do you put up there before you have Embiid? I mean, is he top five? I mean,
you want the honest truth. To me, he's like top two. I think it's LeBron and then him. You know, with Harden, you know, if Paul's in the game, they've closed games with Paul, you know, kind of finishing it off, you know, or at least kind of extending the lead. You know, Steph now with we see the Warriors have and that monster lineup. You know, Westbrook last year for sure, it was, you know, when he went to the bench, it was like, okay, this is a problem. But this year they got Paul George, they have Carmelo, like they can figure some things out. I guess the other guy too would be Giannis that you'd have to include in that. You know, where when he goes to the bench, it's a little bit of a struggle for Milwaukee. So I honestly have him at least in the top three. I mean, it's just vast. I mean, it goes nowhere. And like there were possessions where Trevor Booker was posting up yesterday. And I was just like, any possession that has Trevor Booker with the ball in the post that wasn't off of a rebound is a automatic loss.
Yeah, I think one thing that's so fascinating about this is if he's really top three, and I think he's pretty close, you look at his age and you look at his position and you look at his style of play. Playoff Embiid is going to be a nightmare for everybody because he's the ultimate mismatch in terms of just his physicality. How do you guard him? But then also, you can't play your favorite lineups. You know, if you have these like certain ways that you want to play, good luck trying to play five out against, you know, Joel Embiid. And every other series, it might work. I mean, you can definitely play it against Cleveland, against Boston, no problem. Like, he is going to change everything. And so it's just a unique situation. Not only does he impact his own team to this crazy degree, you know, elite level degree, but he impacts the style of play, matchups, lineups, rotations, all that stuff in a way that very, very few people do. I mean, it's right up there, like you're saying, guys like LeBron and Steph, for his age, it's just special.
Yeah, he's a matchup nightmare. In general, anytime the Knicks are lucky because they have Porzingis, and you could say, "Hey, let's put Porzingis on him or whatnot." And not a lot of teams have a 7'3" Latvian or just a 7'3" human being for that matter. You know, where it's just he's a nightmare, and I think in the playoffs it could be a huge problem for teams. You know, getting away from Philly a little bit and to the Knicks, the one thing that really pissed me off with the Knicks, and I had mentioned it on Twitter, I mentioned it at halftime of that game, where they were running kind of like the Dirk play, where it was a high pick and roll, and then the ball goes to Porzingis in the high post. And the Sixers were switching it a few times, and they'd end up having a small guard like McConnell or Bayless guarding him, and he would just shoot over him. And they got away from that in the fourth quarter, and I was just kind of looking at it going, like, you have a play that they literally cannot stop. They didn't have an answer for it, and they get away from it, and then the one time down the stretch where they run it, you know, they get poor spacing on the weak side, and that's when Simmons comes up with a steal and a dunk that pretty much sealed the game. And it frustrated me going, like, you have a play they can't stop. You have to run it constantly, every time. You got to keep doing it. So I was a bit frustrated with that in general. No,
I hear you on that. One thing I'd say, just if we're going to take a slightly more optimistic view of this, Porzingis' development, like, from last year to this year, and then once you know he's going to recognize that stuff and really make teams pay for it by this time next year, you know, it starts to make you salivate a little bit. I just think his progress as a scoring weapon's been really impressive. You know, not only just the raw scoring number, but the different places on the court where he can beat you as a one-on-one threat. I mean, I think he still definitely needs to learn. You know, it's almost like he should watch earlier career LaMarcus Aldridge stuff. Like, how do you handle when the second body comes? You know, how do you deal with it when, you know, they're sending the double from different places that you're not expecting, or bodies are flashing through the paint that, you know, and you're thinking instead of just playing the game and reacting and making the simple pass or the right pass? I think that stuff is going to slowly come for him. But I think by this time next year, he's going to have enough reps in terms of these situations, and he is going to have even more of a well-honed killer instinct where, like, if you do get switched on him with, like, I think it was McConnell late in the game, maybe, he's not going to hesitate. He's just going to punish you for that. And he's not going to necessarily just settle for you know, that turnaround where the guy's up underneath him and crowding him and trying to make his life a little bit difficult. He might have a one dribble move and, you know, a dream shake or a shoulder shimmy or just a counter that those guys can't do anything with, regardless of their size. And I think he's progressing, you know. Let's put aside his 0-for-11 night against Boston the other night, which was pretty rough. But his progress in terms of overall offensive stuff has been pretty awesome. I think it's one of the biggest stories of the season. I keep hearing people saying, like, Oladipo for most improved player. I mean, to me, you take Porzingis's overall offensive growth combined with, I think, his improved effectiveness as an interior defender. I mean, he just seems to be making smarter plays, much smarter plays than, you know, earlier in his career where he's just constantly in foul trouble night after night. Better positioning, using his length better. I think style of play in terms of more teams playing five out so he can be the center and just the longest guy on the court by a mile. I think that helps him a little bit. To me, he's the most improved player. If he stays healthy, that's his award.
Yeah, I think it's going to end up just going to Oladipo because of the storyline and all that stuff. But you're right, though. Like, Porzingis has improved a ton. And being the man, like, you can see it. Like, he knows now he's the man. There's a confidence there. You know, you can even the 0-for-11 night, like, he's a young guy. He's going to have those nights on occasion. It's can you grow from those? And I think he can. I think, you know, he wants it. We see that he wants it. It's going to be fun to watch Porzingis over the next few years really develop that I'm the guy kind of mentality.
Yeah, in terms of guys who we want to see on Christmas, let's keep him in that spot. You know, let's lock Porzingis in and let's just keep rotating the guys he plays against. One year it's Embiid, one year it's Giannis. I mean, just, you know, one year it's Towns. I mean, just cycle through in these unicorn battles. Let's do it.
I mean, we got a ton of unicorns. This is it's becoming an issue. Let's move on a little bit. Let's move on to the Golden State Cleveland game, which is kind of, I guess, the main course, right? This is the game everybody really kind of wanted to watch. What were your takeaways from that? How much does that game matter to you in the grand scheme of things? You know, seeing that this is most likely going to be the finals matchup.
Yeah, I liked how LeBron put it, saying it was kind of a feel-out game just because the point guards weren't out there. And I actually thought, from sort of an analysis perspective, having Steph out of the game actually helped, because it was sort of like an equalizer in terms of, okay, what do the rest of these rosters look like? And I think, you know, Steph is a pretty clearly better all-around player than Isaiah, and I think in a finals matchup he's like much more valuable. But just kind of getting to see the rest of the rosters, point guards aside, go head-to-head made it more effective of an exercise in terms of kind of comparing them. I came away from that game with fairly big concerns for Cleveland, if I'm being honest. You know, first of all, if LeBron plays at an A-plus level like he does in the finals, they probably win that game. I mean, he was not at an A-plus. I would say, you know, he was sort of at a B or a B-plus. Golden State, you know, did pretty well with them. But I think the biggest issues to me were the defensive breakdowns in the fourth quarter, you know, a couple minutes preceding the two non-calls, which everybody was talking about. You know, Wade lets a leak out go behind him after missing a three-pointer. I think Livingston cashes that in for a dunk.
Yeah.
You see Kevin Durant go coast-to-coast blocking a shot. Nobody stops the ball. Everybody's pointing. He gets a dunk on the other end. You see a second-chance three for Klay Thompson where there's an offensive rebound breakdown. He's wide open at the angle. Nobody's on him. He gets a completely clean look. I know that one really bothered the Cavaliers coaching staff and LeBron because, you know, I read their comments and listened to them after the game. And then there's also LeBron. I don't know if it was fatigue or just, you know, a mental lapse, but, you know, Draymond basically beats him from the top of the key to the rim for a lob on a pretty easy high-low play, you know, without really any screening action or anything else like that. So you look at the number of defensive breakdowns in quick order combined with the number of different parts of Cleveland's roster and rotation that broke down. And to me, it was a little bit scary. Like, this didn't seem like a team that's going to be able to flip a switch and play championship defense. I mean, you have that many different guys making very fundamental and obvious mistakes against a team that really wasn't clicking. And during the fourth quarter, you know, that really combined had me nervous. And you cross-check that with the fact that their defense is like bottom five in the league and that they don't really have a good individual defensive matchup for Kevin Durant. I mean, Crowder tries, but I think he's really overmatched. You know, Jeff Green, I don't know if Jeff Green just didn't get the memo that they were playing on Christmas. Or maybe he was playing on a different holiday. Who knows? But he was really a non-factor there. So you add all of those things up, and then you remember Steph is going to come back into this and totally warp Cleveland's defensive scheme just by his mere presence on the court, because you have to pay him so much attention. I came away from that game pretty nervous on Cleveland's behalf and wondering whether we should be discussing more about what kind of midseason additions they could make to sort of fortify this roster and rotation.
Yeah, the one thing with the Cleveland side that really kind of surprised me was Channing Frye not getting any burn. Going into it, you know, that streak where they had and stuff like that, like he was coming off the bench and doing a pretty good job defensively. Not great. It's Channing Frye. It's not like he's going to make a huge difference or anything, but he was able to stay on the court defensively and then hit shots offensively. And I felt like I was a bit surprised that he didn't get any run at all, considering how well that second unit was defending with him in the game, in other games. And I get it, like the Warriors kind of make everybody change their game plan. To me, it doesn't mean much exactly, because Steph wasn't in there. No Isaiah. Like, this could be two completely different teams come June. Actually, correction. The Cavs could be completely different come June, whereas the Warriors are pretty much going to – this is who they are. The other thing – listen, Durant was great defensively. Forget about the non-calls down the stretch. You know, he had five blocks that game, and he was just all over the court defensively, crashing the glass. You know, seven rebounds isn't a ton, but he just kind of used his length. He's making it hard and difficult for the Cavs there. I was pretty impressed with his defensive game. Do you think he has a chance at Defensive Player of the Year?
I think he should be in the conversation. I think the big story around Durant, though, right now is it seems to me that he has set his mind to something, and that is the only way he's going to win back the public, and he's clearly lost them. I think everyone would agree on that. The only way he can win back the public is if he unseats LeBron as the best player in the league, right? So all this focus on his defense, you know, a lot of comments he made about how much that's become a priority for him. I think his attention and focus late in that game trying to lock down LeBron, and for the record, I thought LeBron got fouled both times, but, you know, I wasn't like, I didn't think it was terrible, but Durant seems laser focused on that idea that, like, he's got to knock LeBron off. Otherwise, he's going to sort of be stuck, you know, from a narrative standpoint at this point of his career. And I love it, because guys hit with his level of talent should play as hard defensively, especially when they're as gifted physically as he is in terms of the length, in terms of the versatility, the quickness, that whole package. Letting all that stuff go to waste because of, you know, over-focus on becoming a scoring champion, or just inattentiveness, or, you know, maybe like you have guys like Ibaka earlier in your career who are kind of covering for you, Perkins who are covering for you. That's a shame, you know, and I have always loved following Durant's career since the start, and it is a revelation that he's decided to take it this seriously on this end, and I'm glad he did while he's still kind of in his prime and not fading, because it would have been a real regret, I think, if he had waited a little bit longer. In terms of the lineups and the matchups in that game specifically, though, I mean, certainly he's the best. Like, that combination between him and Draymond far exceeds any 4-5 combination that Cleveland can put on the court in terms of defensive ability. And I think, you know, one other takeaway for me, I mean, Kevin Love was sensational in that game, you know, causing lots of problems. And a guy who hits the offensive glass and just really pounds like he does is going to create issues for Golden State, especially if they're not playing big with a guy like Zaza or someone else of that ilk. But I do wonder if what he did on Christmas was a little bit of a mirage. And you know, if you don't agree, you know, feel free to correct me. But I just think not having Steph on the court to really put Love into space defensively and make him work on that end and really exploit him kind of gave him a little bit of a night off. I mean, when the ball is in the hands of guys like Durant, Draymond, and Iguodala, you know, a big like Kevin Love doesn't have to defend with as much energy and doesn't have to cover as much ground. And he's not constantly worried about a pull-up three from, you know, 30 feet. It's just a different defensive challenge. So I think Love's success was in part due to Steph's absence. He's able to really, you know, go nuts offensively and channel more energy on that side because he doesn't have quite the same level of defensive responsibilities. And I do think, you know, once both teams are at full strength, you know, give them Isaiah, and put Steph back on the court, it's going to be so easy to attack those Isaiah Love pick and roll situations, try to force switches in those kinds of scenarios where Love's life is going to be much more difficult come June.
The other thing too, when Isaiah comes back, is I don't see Love getting 25 shots.
Oh, for sure.
That number is going to drop a ton. I think you're right on with the analysis of without Steph on the court, Love was able to chill a little bit, and it will be something Lou's going to have to figure out when teams are going to, it's not just going to be the Warriors. Every team in the playoffs is going to hunt that, putting both Thomas and Love into the pick and rolls. Like, every team is going to do it. So they're going to have to, honestly, they're going to have to start now trying to figure out what they need to do to somehow avoid that. The other thing, the last guy I want to talk about for the Warriors, though, Iguodala had a nice game. You know, it was a nice, he had a coast-to-coast layup. He looked pretty young and spry. Like, he kind of saved himself just enough for, like, I'm going to show up for this game. Do you think that's something that he's going to be able to carry over come playoff time?
Yeah, should we just call him Manu Iguodala and just, dispense with all the formalities? I mean, doesn't that what it feels like? I mean, and people were killing him last week on Twitter. I was reading all the Iguodala hate and kind of thinking, like, huh, this doesn't seem like the right take at all. I mean, it seems pretty clear he gets up when he wants to get up. And I think he's still got it on that level where he can frustrate LeBron, in June, in those late game situations with his hands, with his understanding of where LeBron wants to go. And I think, Golden State's overall defense really made life pretty difficult on LeBron. He didn't get to the free throw line that much, aside from the no calls late. Durant's length at times was very limiting for LeBron, and always having that back line with a guy like Draymond able to rove, that's been the formula that has really toppled LeBron here these last couple of years. And you look around the league, everyone's had trouble keeping LeBron away from the rim, away from those super high percentage two-pointers. And Cleveland's two-point shooting last night was pathetic. I mean, it was terrible. I don't know what it was, but it was like in the 20s or 30s. That's not going to get it done against Golden State, especially once they've got Steph back and their offense is really rolling. I mean, Golden State didn't even do that great of a job in terms of shooting the three ball. They weren't living on the free throw line themselves. I mean, it was just kind of a blah offensive effort. So, like I said, real causes for concern on the Cleveland side.
Yeah, I'm with you. And the other thing, too, is I think Iguodala played the perfect amount of minutes. 24 minutes is just perfect for him, and to keep him kind of spry throughout the whole game and not really tired. So before we move on to that, I got to tell you, Ben, about my favorite gelato shop. Anybody who listens to the podcast knows I'm a gelato fanatic. Even in the wintertime, I still find a way to visit Uli's Gelateria in downtown LA. You can't go wrong, Ben. I know it's wintertime, but next time I see you, I'm gonna try to bring you some gelato. I think it'll make you happy. It'll cheer up any woes you might have. We might send some to Toronto Raptors fans.
Here's what I'd say, Mo. I mean, I was up in Portland over the weekend. It was a white Christmas up there, and you come home to LA, boy, it doesn't feel like Christmas down here. It's gelato weather. There's no question. And the other inside baseball thing I tell listeners, Mo's always out here slanging his gelatos on the podcast, but he does it in real life too. I mean, this guy is a gelato salesman. So he is really about that gelato life. If you like gelatos, listen to Mo.
Yes. Yes. I am telling you, you can't go wrong with Uli's Gelateria in downtown LA. Spring Arcade in between 5th and 6th Street, and they have a second location, which I haven't visited yet, but I will make my way there at some point, by the Beverly Grove on 3rd in between Fairfax and Crescent Heights. You can't go wrong. If you go there, check out the Speculoos cookies, my favorite flavor. You can't go wrong. If you're a vegan, they have vegan flavors. They got it all for everybody. So I can't recommend enough Uli's Gelateria. So I know you didn't get a chance to watch a lot of that Boston-Washington game. And I was a little bit sad because I was hyped up for this game because I was just hoping there'd be a bit more of that rivalry and that kind of back and forth that we saw during that playoff series. Do you think this rivalry is kind of dead just with the fact that the Celtics have brought almost a brand new team in?
I think so, but I think the key part was that guys like John Wall and Bradley Beal didn't feel like it was dead, right? Like, they still felt a little chafed, it seemed like, based on that last, you know, the way that the last year's playoffs went down. I mean, losing to Kelly Olynyk in a game seven, I mean, that's going to stick with you, I would hope, at least until Christmas. I mean, regardless of if Isaiah Thomas is there and Crowder's not there and Amir Johnson's not there and Olynyk's not even there, I mean, I hope that kind of a loss would stick with you. The Wizards have been pretty confounding. I mean, they do seem to have kind of settled into this idea that, like, you know, they can just kind of turn it up when they want to. It's an awesome matchup. Just go position by position, personality by personality. Even with all the changes on Boston's side, it's just fascinating, you know, especially if Hayward's back. I think that would really take it to the next level. So I want to say it's kind of like a rivalry on pause, you know, or it's sort of like trying to put the pieces back together. But I think, you know, if those two teams were to face off like in a second round playoff series, that would be must see TV and probably one of the best second round playoff series.
I mean, that's kind of something I'm hoping for, is that we do get them again in the second round going back and forth. I mean, Washington is very much the annoying kid that just talks a ton of trash and always feels slighted by every little thing. You know, if you invite your friends out to something but somehow left out another friend, you know, next time you see him, you get that kind of attitude of like, yo, what the hell? Why didn't you invite me? Kind of thing. And I feel like we get that from Washington like that. They just feel like they're constantly sort of ignored.
They all overcompensate for it, too. I mean, they're wearing just like $20,000 worth of Gucci. Everybody's just decked out in gold. It's like, look at me. Look at me. Like, we're a real contender. Well, play like a contender. We'll give you credit. You know, that's what bugs me. And to their credit, I mean, they came out on Christmas and turned in, I think, I mean, probably their most impressive win of the season. I know early in the year they beat Toronto, I think, in Toronto. Other than that, if you look at their schedule, I mean, they basically don't have any quality wins, unless you want to be real generous and say beating Detroit's a quality win. But, I mean, these guys have basically beaten nobody all season long. So I think that they deserve to strut a little bit after that one.
Yeah, and the truth is, like, watching the Celtics, like, I didn't feel like they really took this game that serious. Kyrie was really disinterested on defense more than anything else. Like, he died on a ton of screens, like, and it wasn't even close, you know. I felt like there was just kind of a, we're here. I know Kyrie doesn't really think Christmas is a holiday, but I feel like he was a little disappointed he was playing. All of that stuff. It just overall, like, I didn't feel like there was great energy from the Celtics throughout the game. So I wasn't surprised that they lost or anything like that. But let me ask you this question about the Celtics, because it's talked about ad nauseum now, you know, and I don't even know if it's possible, but do you bring Gordon Hayward back if the doctors say, hey, he's healthy, he can play? Let's say it's a week before the playoffs begin.
Well, Mo, I'm going to ask you a rhetorical question that I think you could probably already guess what it's going to be. What would Pop do? And there's no way Pop would rush Gordon Hayward back into the mix like this. And, you know, I'll admit, I've always kind of been a Pop disciple in terms of just how they take the long-term view. I think it's really smart. But just from a story time perspective, I remember when Brandon Roy got rushed back to a playoff series for the Blazers. And I think he had meniscus surgery, and he might have come back like 8 days after he had the surgery, just something completely absurd like that. And obviously meniscus surgery is not like the world's biggest deal, but still, that's not what you're supposed to do. It's not the safe and prudent approach, but somehow the Blazers doctors and coach and everybody else let him on the court and front office okayed it and all of that. That was basically the end of his functional career, you know, and that's always kind of stayed with me and scarred me. So my answer is always caution. Especially with Boston's life cycle. I mean, you look at Horford, to me, that is one piece. You know, he could age a little bit more quickly than people expect. Everybody else on the roster is going to be there whenever Hayward wants to return. If he doesn't want to return until next Christmas, that's fine by me. You know, just take it slow and steady wins the race here. Kyrie is still kind of cresting into his prime. These young guys are going to be impact players, like Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, are going to be impact players for a decade. Like, this shouldn't be a conversation, and I'm sure it probably will be, like you mentioned, but to me the answer is obvious.
Yeah, it's a funny thing too, that what people don't even kind of really talk about, it's like, you know, if you could add Gordon Hayward, you do it. I go, no, you don't, when you already have your kind of system in place. Like, your team has gotten through the whole season without him. They're adjusted a certain way to play without him. Tatum's used to playing without him. Brown's used to playing without him. They've stepped up and they've taken on bigger roles with him not on the court. to try to throw a wrench in just before the playoffs and go, all right, now we got this shiny piece, Gordon Hayward. Now work him in, you know, a week before the playoffs or something like that. I'm just like, this is just a bad idea. Forget about the long-term health of Hayward, which is a big component for me of also why I wouldn't play him. But you just throw everything you've done all season into a tailspin, because then you're gonna lose a game or two just by trying to incorporate him and guys trying to feel him out. It would just be too weird. It wouldn't be something I would recommend at all.
Yeah, I mean, here's another cautionary tale. A guy named Isaiah Thomas. I think Celtics fans are familiar with him, right? I mean, he plays through that playoffs, and I know he told Rachel Nichols on Christmas that he wished he hadn't done that. If he could go back and do it over, he wouldn't have. You never know what kind of auxiliary damage you can do when you're trying to play through injury or trying to rush back from an injury. You don't want to be on the court unless you're feeling 100% right. You don't want to have any doubts. And that's something we saw with Paul George coming back from his leg injury too. I mean, remember that really ugly, like 4 or 5, 6 games, whatever he played at the end of that season, where he just wasn't right. And at one point he had to be carried off the court. You don't want to be dealing with that stuff during the playoffs. You know, to me, it's a distraction. It's bad for your player. It's bad for your organization. And it's tough. I mean, nobody wants to say we're intentionally holding a guy out. But even if he was healthy this season, I would sit him. Because the last thing you want to do is not have Gordon Hayward ready to go at the start of next year, right? Because there's a situation where, what if LeBron leaves? You know, are you the default number one seed with Hayward back? Probably. Don't you want to have him get 82 games of cohesion and chemistry with his teammates? I think you would want that. So to me, this is a non-conversation. Just, you know, see you in September.
Yeah, and the Paul George comparison that people bring up, well, Indiana did it with Paul George. Indiana wasn't going to the playoffs. Like, that also might have been a mental thing for Paul George of, like, I need to get on the court and then get ready, you know, to feel like I could still do it. That might have been a thing for him. And you were right, and I probably wouldn't have allowed it if I was Indiana, but they weren't going anywhere. Like, this is a different case with Boston that I think, you know, they're going to be in the conference finals, in my opinion. So I think that's a why risk anything? Why screw up your team's chemistry and all of that to just potentially add a piece that I still don't think they're good enough to beat the Warriors in the finals. I don't even think they'll beat the Cavs to get to the finals.
Yeah, well, let me ask you this. I mean, they haven't been playing that well here the last week or two, at least compared to, obviously, their incredible November. Are you still confident they're going to make the conference finals? Because that field, to me, is pretty deep. You know, I think Toronto could be in that conversation. I think Washington could be in that conversation. I still think Milwaukee could be in that conversation. I definitely think Cleveland's going to be there. I mean, to me, they're coming out of the East still, you know, basically no matter what, barring some major injury to LeBron. Are you really confident that Boston's, like, just got that path locked up?
Yeah, I am. I think it won't be as smooth. It won't be sweep, and we're in the conference finals. But I think I know that a lot of guys during that streak were playing well over their heads, and I'm looking at Aaron Baines directly. But, you know, that's you know, something I think you see that's the best they could play, and that's their ceiling. So I think you can kind of – I kind of have them better than the Wizards. I think the Wizards are just a shaky team to me. I don't think they're that deep. I think they're all about, I want to be an NBA player and show the lifestyle off, but not really that committed and things like that. The Raptors, look, the Raptors are going to be there. They're going to battle. I think I could see the Raptors beating them, but I'm not 100% sure. I still think I would pick the Celtics over those guys. Just the young kids are really good, and I think they can give DeRozan problems, Lowry problems. And let's be honest, the Raptors have not been great in the playoffs. Like, they kind of just shit the bed. So Milwaukee,
yeah, the Raptors are one of the most fascinated teams, I think, to watch heading into these playoffs, because they basically did the checklist of things you're supposed to do. They're taking more threes. They're taking less contested twos. They're keeping the minutes off Lowry, so he should be fresh. They're encouraging DeRozan to shoot more threes, and he's kind of being able to do it. They're going deeper into their bench. They're playing. I think they're kind of weaning themselves off of the big centers more so than in previous years. So, like, they're heading right in the direction that they should be. But then this playoffs, I think it's going to sort of be a test. Like, how good is their talent actually, right? Like, yeah. Are these guys legitimately top 20 players? Or are they in that, like, 20 to 40 range where they can carry you to 50 wins, but that's it?
Yeah, and that's really something we're gonna have to. We're only gonna know come playoff time. Like, there's no real way to judge that now. Real quick, because I know we're kind of running out of time. What did you see in the Houston OKC game? Did you feel like the Thunder have kind of figured it out and are beginning to turn it around? They've winners of five straight. Houston losers of the last three. No Chris Paul. Like, what do you see of that match?
Yeah, I think much like the people who want to write off the Warriors game because Steph wasn't in it, I think that there's a tendency to say, well, Chris Paul didn't play, so it doesn't matter. I go the other way. I think this game did matter for one main reason. Harden, to me, has been the MVP so far through the season. He has made it look so easy on a nightly basis, scoring the basketball, breaking defenses down. You can't say enough good about his offensive impact. However, Oklahoma City really, really, really bamboozled him and made life really difficult for him, especially late in that game. And you look at their personnel, Robertson and Paul George. I mean, if you were going to go to a laboratory and build two Harden stoppers, those might be the first two guys you come up with, you know, other than maybe Kawhi. I mean, these guys, in terms of their length, their quickness, their strength, they're not going to get bullied. And also their commitment on the drive. I mean, they're not the kinds of players who are going to give you 5 feet. You know, with one dribble move, you can create all this separation. They're right there with you. Everyone always talks about Avery Bradley's ability to kind of mirror ball handlers. I think Robertson's right there with him. And honestly, the fact that he can do it across more positions, you know, against bigger wings might even be more impressive than what Bradley does. I mean, they're sort of like dance partners out there. When Harden's doing his thing on the ball, I mean, Robertson just really shadows him so well. It's fun to watch. Obviously, he has his flaws as a player in terms of what he's bringing to the table offensively. But I thought Harden lost that matchup, you know, especially late. And I didn't necessarily expect that. Chris Paul could help with that. But the whole key to Houston making the conference finals is Harden being unlocked. And if Oklahoma City has these wings that have shown the ability to lock him up, if they have a strong home court advantage, if they've got a pretty good rim protecting presence in Adams behind all of it to take away some of the easy stuff at the basket, that sounds like a formula to make Houston's life, you know, fairly difficult. And it played out just like that on Christmas. I have been a big time skeptic of Oklahoma City all season long. I don't view them as sort of a title worthy contender. They're definitely playing better here recently. But I really think the big takeaway for them is that, you know, these interchangeable wings that they got ostensibly to kind of match up with Golden State are actually really practical and helpful in matching up against Houston, and that might be the more immediate concern for them.
Yeah, I'm with you. You know, it's funny. Harden did have a rough night and still put up 29. Like, you know, but it was a tough night. It was difficult. These dudes in his face constantly. I'm more of the sense of, like, I feel confident in Oklahoma City turning it around. I think I was very happy to see Melo only took 12 shots instead of what he's accustomed to, which is like 18 to 19, you know, and efficient too, going 8 for 12 and things like that. Defensively, they're solid. And once they figure out the offense, and I think they're getting closer and closer to it, kind of figuring out the right amount of ingredients of how much Westbrook, how much George, how little of Melo, you know, and what do they need? Where can they get Adams going and stuff like that? Robertson making the cuts. You know, he's been doing a good job lately, kind of like making baseline cuts out of the pick and rolls, and they're finding him and things like that. I think we're really close to seeing Oklahoma City kind of going on a run. You know, they're winners of five straight. They might drop a game here or there. I think they're going to go on a pretty long. I think they got a 10, you know, 12 game win streak in them somewhere. And I think we're going to kind of, everybody's going to start to jump back onto the bandwagon a bit.
Well, yeah, they've earned that. I mean, Westbrook's back from the abyss, too. I mean, he had a really, really rough first 6 or 7 weeks to the season, and he looks better. And they go where he goes. I mean, that's pretty obvious. I agree. More Westbrook and less Melo is the start of a formula for them offensively. I would also say, though, they're still thin. You know, and some of their issues earlier this season in terms of dropping games they shouldn't have dropped. Like, if they're on a back-to-back, maybe they didn't have the energy like the game against the Knicks. But also, you know, if a guy like Adams misses a game, or Paul George is banged up with some minor thing, whatever it might be, like, they just get stretched so quickly with that rotation. They need all hands on deck to do the kind of, you know, successful things that you're mentioning, where, you know, long extended winning streaks and the kind of things I'm talking about, which is, you know, really challenging good teams in the playoffs. they just cannot afford anyone to be out of the lineup. And I think that, you know, flip side, the same can probably be said for Houston too. I mean, they did a great job of weathering Paul's extended absence. I mean, Harden was just masterful and brilliant that whole way. But here recently, no Paul. I know Capella missed a little bit of time too. I think Mbamute had a shoulder. Those kinds of things add up. I mean, D'Antoni wants to play eight guys. If we're talking about three players are injured, that screws your entire game plan if you have three guys, even guys who are complementary players, out of the lineup. So I wouldn't overreact from Houston's side, but I do think Oklahoma City's ability to contain Harden, especially late, like that silly three he threw up where, you know, Robertson's challenging. I mean, that's a bad habit that's coming out in a stressful situation, and Harden hasn't had too many stressful situations so far this year because they've just been waxing everybody. That kind of stuff where you're trying to gimmick for a call on a three-pointer instead of really finding a good quality shot for yourself or somebody else in a key crunch time situation, that's the kind of stuff that kills him against Golden State in the playoffs because he makes those same decisions constantly, and often they lead to turnover or poor low-percentage shots. He's got to work that stuff out of his system.
Yeah, I'm with you 100% on that. Nothing drives me more batshit crazy than the pump fake, get the defender in the air, I'm going to jump into the defender and try to draw the foul and get the shot where I'm like, just take your normal shot. You're probably going to make it, you know. And
yeah, you're like a top two bucket getter in the league. Just play. You're good.
Don't worry about it. And that side of it. So that does drive me nuts. And it's not just Harden. Everybody does it in the league. It's actually really getting to the point I'm going to probably do a video breakdown at some point. Let me ask you this last question about OKC, and then we'll move on to the late game, and then I'll get you out of here. Do you trade Paul George?
Well, I was thinking it was going that way as recently as like a week ago, but they just need to be relevant. I mean, that's the standard. If they're relevant, if they can talk themselves into winning a series and challenging in round two, then they'll keep them, you know, because I think that was sort of what their stated purpose was. If they're feeling like their first round bait, you know, like they're going to just get run over by somebody better and they're not in position to have, say, like that 4 or 5 seed where now you're avoiding San Antonio, Houston, and Golden State, then, you know, that's when you have to really think seriously about trading them. But they have definitely stabilized here in the last week, and you don't want to overreact to, you know, their best stretch of the year, just like you don't want to overreact to their worst stretch of the year. But you got to give them their credit. I mean, they played very well on Christmas. They're looking better in general. And Westbrook, like I said, this isn't a situation where like he's a different player than he was last year. And that's what it was looking like in November, where when you're shooting, you know, what, 38, 39% from the court, and you're shooting 30% on three-pointers, and you're jacking up tons of crazy shots, you're not finishing at the rim. That was where it was getting really scary. And you're starting to think like, look, you got to trade Paul George and get out in front of this, because otherwise the next 3 or 4 years are going to get ugly. Instead, I think, like I said, stabilization is kind of the key word right now. If they keep that going forward, I think Paul George will still be there.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think come playoff time, they're actually a tough out. They got a ton of talent. You know, if they're a 4 or 5 seed, I have them definitely in the second round. But they're a team that nobody in the top three are going to want to play in the first round either, because they're again, a very difficult team to have to scheme against and cover. Whereas I don't think, I mean, as good as Houston is, I think Houston's easier to plan for in the playoffs because D'Antoni plays one way. And if you can figure out a way to stop that team, or you can figure out that one way to slow it down, because I guess there's no real stopping it, but slow them down a bit, you have a shot. Whereas the we've seen it with the really good teams, they can play multiple different ways, different styles. So I think Oklahoma City, if they can get in the playoffs, they can get a 4 or 5 seed, they're a dangerous team. And again, just with their talent level, they're a tough out.
Yeah, my last point on Houston would just be that I think Chris Paul represents a little bit of that diversification that you want to see. I think there's going to be times in the playoffs where if they are feeling bottled up, if Harden is feeling like, you know, defenses are just overloaded on him, if some of those complimentary shooters aren't hitting those like crazy 30-foot three-pointers under the playoff pressure like they were, say, in November, that a guy like Chris Paul can step forward, probe the mid-range, get to some pick-and-roll stuff with Capella, and just give a slightly different look that they haven't had in previous seasons. I'm kind of banking on that happening. We'll see if it actually does. I still really like Houston. I think they're going to be in the conference finals this year. But there's no question, like, if they face Oklahoma City, say, in the second round, that will be a bloodbath. And I think if you're Golden State, I think that's the one team that can look at Oklahoma City and still feel like they have major matchup advantages across the line. But I think San Antonio would be nervous about the Thunder as well. And I don't think we should move the goalposts either, by the way, for the Thunder. They had a tough start. There's no doubt about it. But coming into the season, they were supposed to be a top four team in the West. I mean, they, on paper, they're better than Minnesota, Denver, Portland, Utah, Clippers, Grizzlies, whoever else you wanted to put in that mix. They were supposed to be number four. So if they get back to that spot, they should be favored in that first round series, and they should win it. And if they don't, they'll be a disappointment.
Yeah, I'm with you definitely on that one. Even if they're the fifth seed or sixth, like, you know, a fifth seed, they should still win that series. They don't necessarily need the home court for as talented as that team is. Let's go to the evening game, which I'll be honest, I tended to fade a bit at that point, just kind of punch drunk on basketball. The Wolves and the Lakers, no Ingram, no Lonzo. What'd you take away from that game? What'd you see? You were at the game. What'd you see, and you know, what were your thoughts?
You know, I honestly didn't make it down there as a kind of a last-minute scheduling thing, but I didn't have a lot of takeaways from that game other than Minnesota did what they were supposed to do. They are really sticking to their own script. You know, it's like D'Antoni and Thibodeau have these opposite reputations, like offensive guru, defensive guru, but they really do share a stubbornness when it comes to kind of their rotations and minutes allotments and all of that. And so, like, one takeaway was the final buzzer. You know, Jimmy Butler's like doubled over, exhausted, hands on his knees, you know, beating the Lakers, this depleted Lakers team on Christmas. And it's like, that seems like a bad sign. That seems like a warning sign that maybe Thibodeau needs to, you know, loosen up his rotation a little bit. But there really wasn't much to be found. I mean, Towns had some really nice moments. One really, you know, fantastic dunk over Corey Brewer. Otherwise, the Timberwolves kind of are who they are. To me, they're a little bit of paper tigers. You know, I don't think that they're as good as their record indicates. I don't think that they're going to make as much noise in the playoffs as, you know, they might hope. I think, you know, part of that is due to how many minutes they're playing their main guys. Part of that is due to, you know, they're kind of outperforming their point differential. I kind of expect that to come back to earth. And I worry about injuries, frankly, with them. You know, somebody's going to get run into the ground here, and they're not very deep. And it's very similar to like what we were saying with Oklahoma City and Houston, where, you know, you take one or two guys out of their group, or, you know, God forbid, you take Jimmy off the court for a week or two for them. That's going to be a lot of losses really quickly.
Yeah, they have flame out potential to me by playoff time. Just exactly as you said, the vision of Jimmy Butler kind of doubled over after the game, you know, and 41 minutes to you know, for him to beat the Lakers without, you know, some of their top players, that says a lot. And come playoff time, like, I just don't see them having the legs to really do anything, you know. And
can I tell you a funny story about Jimmy real quick? So I did this big profile on him for Sports Illustrated a few years ago for the magazine. And he told me that his rookie year, I don't know if everybody knows this already, but his rookie year, he was begging Thibodeau to play him. Like, just like basically coming up to him on the bench and begging to get in the game as a rookie. And that team was pretty good his rookie year. And he was like a bit player. I mean, they had Lou Alden, they had all these other guys on the wing. Like, he was not at all a factor. And he finally basically got onto the court, and Thibodeau told him, like, point blank, his rookie year, you know, like, you know, you've been begging me, you've been making all this noise when I play you. Never complain if I play you, right? And so at that time, when I had talked to him 3 years ago, Jimmy, like, just owned that. And he was like, I'll never complain about my minutes. I love it. You know, he's the coach who gave me the opportunity. He's the reason why I'm a breakout. And, you know, that season, he was like an all-star for the first time and his most improved player. And he was like totally all in on this, like, concept of, you know, just basically run me into the ground. This is what I'm here for. You kind of wonder if he made a little bit of a deal with the devil there, didn't he? Right. You know, I mean, like, 3 or 4 years later, he's actually now a guy that I worry about a little in terms of, is he going to hit age 30 and fall off a cliff? You know, and kind of like Dang or Noah or some of these other guys, you know, you hate to wish that on anybody. He does a phenomenal job taking care of his body. He's so physical. I mean, he just punishes people night in and night out. I think it was actually good for Brandon Ingram to just take the night off. You know, I think that could have gotten a little bit ugly for him if they had been matched up. But I do wonder here, like, did he get what he bargained for a little bit? You know, like, he thought he was, you know, talking his way onto the court, and instead he's never going to be able to be taken back off of it ever again.
Yeah. Now he's asking to come off a little bit. It's sort of a be careful what you wish for kind of moment.
Exactly.
Ben, I think that's a good place to wrap it up. There's not much to say about the Lakers, so we're just going to, I'm not even going to go there. Kuzma shot, made 31 points. You know, Kyle Kuzma, everybody here loves him and all that. We can kind of just leave that whole mess alone for the Laker fanatics. Ben, wrap, you know, plug what you're doing. I can't recommend enough the Open Floor podcast. I've never seen co-hosts with such great chemistry and shit talking about Instagram followers. than you two. You know, I follow you. I'm one of your Instagram followers. I'm not very big on the gram. And it even hurt me that I just referred to it as the gram. I don't follow Andrew. So I will, the next time I get Andrew on the show, I probably will follow him at that point.
Yeah, no, we have a good time. I mean, it's the Open Floor podcast. You know, we're talking NBA basically twice a week. I'm sure he's going to be in, you know, full celebration mode because his Wizards won on Christmas Day. He's probably going to want to do 45 minutes on the Wizards and 15 minutes on the rest of the other games, but that's fine. But yeah, no, I'm on Twitter at Ben Golver, and just check us out at si.com/NBA. You know, I wrote a Cavaliers, you know, game recap in terms of what, you know, some of the stuff I mentioned in terms of being worried about them. One thing I didn't mention earlier, I'm a little worried about a lot of their new faces too. I mean, you know, Crowder was fine. Green no-showed. You know, Calderon, you know, that's a rough ask for him against the Warriors. And you know, they made all these moves over the offseason, and I'm not sure how many of those were actually that helpful against Golden State. So I got into that a little bit in that column too. But otherwise, you know, just check me out on Twitter and Instagram, like you mentioned, Ben.Golver. And, you know, it's always good to chat, Mo.
Perfect. I thank you so much, Ben, for coming on, and I look forward to having you again in the new year.
Sounds great, man.
And that's it for our show. Be sure to rate us, like us, leave reviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. Everybody, have a happy new year, be safe, and I will talk to you then.